Several environmental groups have written a letter demanding that the town of Yarmouth and a mill owner fix a broken fish ladder at a dam on the Royal River. The Conservation Law Foundation had previously filed a notice of intent to sue the town and the mill owner over the issue. Sean Mahoney of that foundation told the Portland Press Herald the old dams are keeping the Royal River from being fully restored for recreation and for the return of critical keystone fish. Yarmouth Town Manager Nat Tupper says Yarmouth residents are divided about the dam removal. One concern is about the effect on boatyards downstream.
And they're very worried that the release of any sediment behind the dams would cause a need for dredging and possibly would release any contaminants that are held above the dams, which would then make the dredging far more difficult and more expensive to permit.
Tupper says the town's taken the matter under advisement and has hired an attorney to review the issues and options. The Maine Girls Academy has announced it'll shut its doors later this month. The Portland-based school, which is the only all-girls private school in the state, announced the decision today on its website. The Academy's board chair, Heidi Osborne, says the decision ultimately came down to declining enrollment and revenue. She says only 91 girls were enrolled at the last school year.
We just ran out of runway to be able to turn it into a successful and sustainable school.
Other private schools, including Lee Academy and Maine Central Institute, have been forced to make cuts this year due to similar enrollment situations. Osborne says the Maine Girls Academy has reached an agreement to allow its students to transfer and attend nearby North Yarmouth Academy next year at no additional cost. And over the course of the past school year, we have followed the implementation of Maine's proficiency-based diploma law through the lens of students and staff at Oak Hill High School near Lewiston. In a series we've called Lessons from Oak Hill, we followed the school's approach to meeting the law's requirements that students become proficient in subjects including math, English, and science in order to get a diploma. In our final story in the series, Robbie Feinberg reports on the progress the school has made over the past 9 months, but continues to confront issues that reach far beyond school walls.
Derek Cody arguably has one of the most difficult jobs at Oak Hill High School. He was brought in last year to serve as the school's interventionist.
It's my job to try, over the course of the year, to get them from, I hate school, I don't care, to, I still hate school, but at least I care a little.
You have your book, right?
Yep. Excellent.
When I spent time with Cody in the fall, he was working with small groups of freshman English students, many two or three grade levels behind. And getting them caught up is hard work. Instead of getting out their books, the students chanted and pleaded with Cody to play his guitar instead.
Come on! I'll sing! Come on, get up!
No.
Do it!
I can't. I'm sorry.
Eventually, Cody would get them back on task. And by the second semester, he was visiting math classes too. Often the work would be more pep talk than algebra lesson.
Punch myself in the face, I swear.
Fine, you're fine. Let's just take some review. You got this.
This intervention process can often be slow and time-consuming. But Cody understands. He says the kids are often dealing with issues that stretch far beyond the school walls.
I mean, there are kids who don't have internet access at home and won't. I mean, it's just not going to happen. We have students dealing with abandonment. Some of them live with aunts or uncles or grandparents, or they're dealing with substance abuse or trauma. I mean, you name it.
In early May, trauma affected the entire school when an Oak Hill student died by suicide. A few weeks later, threats forced the school to close down. One senior named Raven says the threats left her confused and scared.
But like, you get home and you think about it and you're like, but what if that did happen? But I mean, it's emotionally draining when it happens all the time.
Staff took action. They brought in counselors to talk with students. And Principal Marco Aliberti says learning basically came to a halt.
To ensure that people are in the right place, because, you know, it affected everyone. Affected everyone in this building, affected everyone in this school community in some way, shape, or form.
We just wanted to make sure our students were safe, knew, and let them know that we are here, we care, and if you can... And if you're ready, then let's try to do some work.
And for some students, the school's new intervention system is what ultimately pushed them to keep going. Raven, the 12th grader, says there were times that she just wanted to quit. But she says having a teacher like Cody to talk with one-on-one made a big difference.
So having these support systems around the school was like almost a safe haven for me. Like when I'm having a hard time, I'm just kind of overloaded. It's like, hey, I just need a second to talk.
By the end of the year, students still had to take standardized tests, and staff braced themselves, expecting negative results. But the percentage of students who were deemed proficient in math and English largely held steady from winter to spring. It was a surprising, mostly positive result, says Principal Marco Aliberti, and he attributes it in part to the new system of emotional and academic supports. But no one is necessarily celebrating. Most teachers I talked with told me that this year was one of their hardest. While Derek Cody says he's proud of what the school has accomplished.
My fear is that people are going to start getting a little burned out because the expectations for teachers are, they're significant. And you're not dealing with products. These kids are going to go on and become, you know, our workers and leaders, and it's a lot of pressure.
Across Maine, teachers have expressed similar worries about their own workloads under proficiency-based diplomas. It's a big reason why legislators have recently passed a bill that would eliminate the diploma mandate, though it's yet to be signed by the governor. But at Oak Hill High School, the mood is more optimistic. Administrators say the new intervention and support systems have already led to positive results. And even if the mandate goes away, many staff hope to stay the course on proficiency-based education. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Robbie Feinberg.
And support for education reporting on Maine Public Radio comes from a grant from the Nellie Mae Education Foundation. Now at 13 minutes before 6, let's check in on the weather forecast with our meteorologist, Paul Janis.
Large ridge of high pressure over the southeast United States will slowly start to slide over Bermuda over the next couple of days. And in its wake, here in New England, we'll have a strong cold front that'll move across the region tomorrow. That'll usher in some clearing skies for the weekend, and we'll be back to near seasonable temperatures and no humidity. Tonight, skies turn mostly cloudy statewide. We'll have developing rain showers before daybreak. Overnight lows between 55 to 60 degrees for the western mountains, 65 to 70 south and coast. Tomorrow will be a cloudy day statewide. Showers and thunderstorms as that cold front sweeps across the northeast United States. High temperatures between 75 to 85 degrees. Tomorrow night, skies become mainly clear across the state. There'll be some areas of patchy valley fog. Lows will be in the 50s. Saturday and Sunday, high pressure moves in from the Great Lakes. It'll be mostly sunny statewide and less humid both days. Highs at 70 to 85 from north to south. This is meteorologist Paul Janis for Maine Public.
And that's Maine Things Considered. Thanks today to Ed Morin, Susan Sharon, Keith Shortall, and Jennifer Mitchell. You can check out our daily news podcast, This Day in Maine, on your favorite podcast app or on NPR One. And you can find more information at mainepublic.org. I'm Nora Flaherty.
On the next Maine Calling, what to read this summer, an encore presentation. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Grab your paper and pen and get ready to add to your reading list as we listen back to Kate Christensen, Richard Russo, and Josh Bodwell share books they are looking forward to reading or rereading this summer. Which books are you most looking forward to? Maine Calling, Friday at 1 and again at 7 on Maine Public Radio.
All Things Considered is made possible by your support. And by Modern Pest, helping businesses prevent rodents, insects, and other pests using EcoCare pest control solutions. ModernPest.com.
Bramwell Tovey conducts works by Bernstein, Gershwin, and Sousa on our next New York Philharmonic broadcast. This is Alec Baldwin. Please join me for this program from the orchestra's Summertime Classic Series. It's the New York Philharmonic this week on this station.
And that's tonight at 8 on Maine Public Classical. You can listen online at many at mainepublic.org, and you can also find Maine Public Classical on air in many parts of the state. We have six FM stations around Maine: Portland, Bangor, Waterville, Western Maine, and Fryeburg, on the southern coast around Booth Bay and Brunswick, and down east from Millbridge. More information or to listen online at mainpublic.org. 10 minutes before 6.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. What life is out there in the universe beyond our planet? And how long can we sustain life on Earth? These are the two big questions at the center of astrophysicist Adam Frank's new book. It's called Light of the Stars, Alien Worlds and the Fate of the Earth. So, Adam, we got a two-hour show here, plenty of time to cover what all known and unknown universes, our collective destiny, the fate of the planet. You're up for that, right?
Yeah, we can get through it really quick, I'm
sure. There we go. Let me start with this number that I read and then went back and reread to see if I had gotten it right. You say that the odds that we, meaning Earthlings, that we are all alone and always were, you put those odds at 1 in 10 billion trillion, meaning you're pretty darn persuaded that there have been other civilizations out there. Persuade
Absolutely.
Me why.
Well, so, you know, even 30 years ago, we did not know whether there were any planets around any other stars in the universe. And of course, we believe that planets are, you know, the first essential step to getting life and civilizations. But in the last 20 years, we've undergone this amazing revolution in astronomy where we now know that every star you see in the sky has planets going around it. And that, you know, if you count up five of them, one of them has a planet in the right place for life to form. So when you add up all the possibilities in the universe, you end up with 10 billion trillion planets where a civilization could have formed. So that's a lot of experiments that the universe has been able to run. And the idea that none of them except ours went all the way to developing a civilization, you know, kind of strains it a bit. So that's why I think that, you know, we are not, unless the universe is really biased against it, what's happening here has happened before.
If you're right, and what's happening here has happened before or is happening right now somewhere in a galaxy far, far away, what can life on other worlds tell us about our own fate?
Well, this really relates to climate change and what this new era that we've pushed the Earth into that people call the Anthropocene, the human-dominated era. And so, you know, as obviously this is a point of contention in politics a lot about the debate, but in science, you know, we've known for quite a while that we've been changing the planet. And from this perspective, what you realize, if you see that there's been many other civilizations, we're not the first, all of them probably push their planets into some era of climate change, that it's almost inevitable if you build a world-girdling civilization that's sucking up a huge amount of energy, that they will all push their planets into climate change. And then the question is, does anybody make it? Does anybody make it to sustainability?
Right. The idea, as you put it, is basically that if there have been advanced societies out there that have developed, that they would be changing their climates and perhaps have self-destructed?
Well, that's the question. So, you know, this perspective, what I call the astrobiological perspective, the kind of cosmic perspective on civilizations in the universe, it changes everything about how we think about climate change. We often think we have to, you know, sort of prove to people that we've triggered climate change. From this perspective, that question doesn't even really exist. It's of course we triggered it. Any civilization that emerges, a technological civilization that emerges on a planet, is really a mechanism for harvesting energy and doing something interesting with it, right? Building your civilization, buildings, whatever. And what we really find from when you consider that is that there's no way for the planet not to respond. So on Earth, we are consuming almost a quarter of the total power that the entire biosphere, the entire collection of life, all the trees and microbes, we consume a quarter of that. How could there not be an effect, right? How could the planet not notice that we're there? So then the question becomes, can anybody make it to sustainability? Can any civilization navigate its transition, its climate change transition, and make it through to the other side where you have a long-term relationship with the planet and you're not wiped out?
So this is, in a way, I mean, it sounds totally terrifying to think that maybe other societies have been out there, been through this, and we don't know about them because they managed to exterminate themselves. On the other hand, this is a comforting message, maybe, right? That we don't need to have quite the angst about climate change as a political issue, because this is completely to have been expected. And the challenge now is, all right, what do we do going forward?
Absolutely. I think that's part of the way this perspective really changes the story we tell. What I like to say is that you can't solve a problem until you understand it, and you can't understand it until you know how to tell its story. And when it comes to climate change, we've been telling the wrong story. And part of that story is that we stink, right? Human beings are a plague on the planet. We're horrible. We're greedy. And look, God knows human beings can do horrible things, but in this respect, triggering climate change was not our fault, right? We've been using energy since for 10,000 years in any form we could find, animal dung, animals themselves, to power civilization. And when we discovered oil, it's not like we, you know, twirled our mustaches and said, I will destroy the planet. Instead, we used it to do amazing things, heating homes, making internal combustion engines. So triggering climate change was not our fault, but not doing something about it now that we've recognized it, not switching energy infrastructures now that we've recognized it. Yeah, not only would that be our fault, but it would be our folly, because what it would mean is that that would be the reason why we didn't make it across the other side. Some civilizations make it and some don't, and that would be the reason why we wouldn't make it.
But again, is all of this completely hypothetical? I mean, we have no actual proof of other civilizations out there.
Part of this revolution in astrobiology and thinking about life and planets together, which we only are just learning how to do, is to look at the history of the Earth, right? The Earth is 4.5 billion years old. There's been life on it for at least, around 4 billion or so. And the Earth has been many different planets, right? For a while, the Earth was a water world. There weren't any continents on there. And there's been times when the Earth has been a snowball world, almost entirely encased in ice. It's been a jungle planet. There was a time when there was no oxygen in the atmosphere, a long period, even when there was life. And it was life itself, microbes, that through their own living processes made the atmosphere oxygen rich. And we wouldn't be there without that. All of those have lessons for us about how we have to reintegrate ourselves as part of the biosphere. We've sort of grown up thinking that we're different from the biosphere. And the lesson of this long view, including thinking about possible other civilizations, is that any civilization that makes it has to reintegrate itself back into the biosphere. You can't just push the biosphere around and expect it's not going to feed back on you. So the real perspective that we gain is we are what the biosphere is doing now. Just as like on other planets that have grown civilizations, that will be what their biospheres were doing. Just like on our planet, there was grasslands. That was the experiment the biosphere was running a while ago. Dinosaurs were an experiment the biosphere was running a long time ago. Mm. We're what the biosphere is doing now, but it doesn't mean we're what the biosphere is going to be doing 10,000 years from now.
Adam Frank, thanks very much.
Oh, it was a real pleasure. Thank you.
Adam Frank, professor at the University of Rochester, also an occasional contributor for our show, and we have been talking about his new book. It is titled Light of the Stars, Alien Worlds and the Fate of the Earth.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Trader Joe's, offering a new 5-part podcast series, Inside Trader Joe's, with the story behind Trader Joe's bananas, plus a tasting panel and a visit to Paris for Madeleine. Available now. More at TraderJoe's.com. From Visiting Angels, professional caregivers assisting adults in bathing, dressing, meals, and light housework nationwide. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care. Office locations are at visitingangels.com. And from the Candida Fund, supporting individual dignity and sustainable communities through investments in transformative leaders and ideas. Learn more at kendedafund.org.
All Things Considered on Maine Public Radio. The show continues into the next hour, and at 6:30, it's today's business news on Marketplace.
The emerald ash borer has made its way across New England, but it's difficult to know exactly where it is.
That is actually one of the big problems with this insect, is how cryptic it is until it's there.
It threatens the culture of the Penobscot Nation in Maine.
You never can accept the death of something that's so ancient and so culturally appropriate in our daily lives.
Join us for Next from the New England News Collaborative.
Next tomorrow afternoon at 2 on Maine Public Radio. This is Maine Public Radio, WMEW Waterville, 91.3, WMED Calais, 89.7, WMEF Fort Kent, 106.5, WMEH Bangor, 90.9, WMEP Camden, 90.5, WMEM Presque Isle, 106.1, and WMEA Portland, 90.1. Also on the web at mainepublic.org.